This evening we're going to move forward in chapter 8 of Romans in lesson 9. And the focal question is, do you really believe that God is for you? Is God really for us or not? Do we really believe that or not? And don't ask me why this thing came with a theta instead of a T. That's just the way it came. Some questions here that might help as not only this evening, but as you think even beyond, some discovery or discussion questions. But in this particular section, we have, among other things, probably one of the most quoted or paraphrased statements that comes out of Romans chapter 8. For we know that all things work together good, but we will get there in a few moments. It's very often taken out of context when it's used. But what makes you, some of the questions that come up, is your suffering, do you think your suffering is any different than anyone else's? You can almost make that into a song.
Yeah, not quite.
Well,
that.
Right. That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up because one of the, actually in the teacher's book, which I glance through each time, it suggested. How do our sufferings and our ideas as Christians of suffering compare with other world religions? And specifically, it mentioned Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam. But Buddhism in particular, the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, actually was raised in the Kshatriya or warrior caste, which was the second highest caste. The Brahmins, the priests, were the highest caste, and then kind of the upper crust were the Kshatriyas or the warriors. And his father had numerous castles, and I guess it would be kind of like if you were to think back to medieval Europe and the fiefdoms there. And he had that with all these little serfs that worked for him. You know, they were three apples high and blue. No, those are Smurfs. But he had all of this. And when Gautama's mother was pregnant, of course, the god of good luck in Hinduism and in Buddhism is Ganesha, who is the elephant god, the elephant-headed god. And a white elephant was not something that you used around Christmas time to have a who gets the white elephant in the room among the gifts, or it wasn't a sale. A white elephant was extreme good luck. And two different stories. One, she dreamed when she was pregnant with him, she dreamed that an elephant entered through her side and blessed the child. The other one, she was walking through the woods and a white elephant showed up and raised his trunk in front of her. And so that was seen as an extreme blessing. She went to a Buddhist priest, a Brahmin, and asked him what that meant. And he said that this child would do one of two things. He would either stay in wealth and power and be the greatest military leader that they had known, or he would throw it all away and seek to prevent suffering and become one who suffered himself and then seek to overcome suffering. When his father found out, he gave strict orders that this child was never to be unaccompanied and if he went from one castle to another castle, one town to another town, they always sent criers out in front of him to let people know if you're old, if you're sick, if somebody died, stay away. He only wanted him to see young people. And so, you know, when he is in his 20s, he ends up one day, somebody didn't get the memo, and he's on his way between castles. His mother died during childbirth, by the way, and so his aunt raised him as a mother. But he goes, and there are two old men that wander too close, and he sees it, and he immediately jumps down off of his horse, and he starts after these men who suddenly realize, uh-oh, we've made a mistake. And as he goes through the town with his handler trailing along behind him, he sees these two really old men, and then he comes upon all these people who are deathly sick, and then he comes upon a funeral procession. And when he asks his the guy that's supposed to be taking care of him and keeping him from seeing this, so what is all this? Well, you're seeing life as it truly is. All people get old, all people get sick, and eventually all people die. And later he will write in his memoirs about that and what a change that made in him. And so he went back, and that night, he had gotten married in between, and he and his wife had an infant son. That night, when everybody was asleep, he kissed his wife, kissed his son, got the friend, rode as far as they could, gave his friend his horse and his clothes, and decided he was going to renounce everything, and he was going to learn suffering and overcome suffering. And he actually almost starved himself to death. In fact, we see the big fat Jolly Buddha. That's Chinese Buddhism. Some of the descriptions, although I don't think he was Dolly Parton, but some of the descriptions where he got so ill, and just before he died, he almost died, and somebody convinced him he didn't need to. That was excessive. They said you could take your hands and put your fingers and touch them around his waist. I mean, he was nothing but skin draped over bones. And so he does come up with that, the Four Noble Truths. All life is suffering. Everything is suffering. That's it. All life is suffering. Suffering is caused by desire, hatred, worldly attachments, ignorance. The way to overcome suffering is to overcome desires and cravings and attachments and ignorance and hatred. And then the way to do that, the fourth noble truth, is to follow the Noble Eightfold Path, which are eight steps that you go through. And only when you do all of that in one lifetime do you get off the wheel of reincarnation. But for him, everything was about suffering. And the only way to get over suffering was to follow that path and to get through it yourself and get off the wheel. You didn't want to come back. You wanted to go into nothingness, which is what nirvana is. Nirvana means to extinguish or to blow out. And so that's a very, Hinduism, Buddhism, they're very much, Islam, everything is fate. Everything is the will of Allah. Nothing you can do about it other than following Allah. And if you're one of the infidels, you deserve to die and die and die over and over again and die forever. But it's very fatalistic. In fact, inshallah, which means if God wills it or if Allah wills it, is probably the most repeated phrase in all of Islam. Because whatever you do, we're going to go to the mall, inshallah, if Allah wills it. Everything is the will of Allah. Good or bad, everything is the will of Allah. Yeah. But everything is the will of Allah. So it's very fatalistic and and suffering is a part of that life. And really the only place that you get any kind of pleasure is in the afterlife. And only then if you follow Allah. And of course, with the martyrs, if you're martyred on behalf of the faith, then if you're a male, you get 40 virgins. If it's during the month of Ramadan, you get 100. That's come about in the last couple of decades. I've asked, you got all these women suicide bombers now, what do they get? I don't know, maybe 40 Chippendales, I don't know. But when I say that, I have visions of them, they go in, and these two little Chippendale come around. Right. Right, the Powerball, right. And so, they're very fatalistic and they're very, talk about downer. And if you're in Hinduism and you're born in the outside the caste system as an untouchable, you can never, ever escape being an untouchable. Forever. Every time you come back, you're an untouchable. You have no hope of moving up in the caste system. And even though Gandhi officially outlawed the caste system, it still operates. It still functions. I've had some...
No.
Right. And so there is that. And Paul deals with these questions here about suffering and about hope and about evil. And in particular, he deals with the questions of what appears to make one wonder. If Christians are no better off than any others, that is, they're mortal, they're subject to passions, they're subject to the flesh, they're sometimes subject to doing wrong or evil, and because of the beliefs they're persecuted, then how can they claim to have been touched by an all-powerful God who has claimed them? You know, I mean, if we're no different than everybody else and we have our sufferings, then what makes us different? How can we claim, and this question, if God is, question that we used to deal with a lot, if God is a loving and good God, then how in the world is there evil, and why does God permit evil, and why does God permit suffering, and all those kinds of things? Even more pointed, some folks will try and argue, say, well, if God is good, then how come God causes suffering?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, that whole thing of choice where Paul comes down on that too. So it appears that the reality is Christians are not different or better off, but Paul starts here by saying, I consider the sufferings of the present time not even worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Or actually it's in us, but most translations say to us. Yeah. So although, you know, the questions are there. If God acted in greatness and love in Jesus, how can you make sense of suffering? And we, you know, people of no faith and people of other faiths just live with us in the squalor and live in the suffering. Paul here is writing, I mean, it was a tough question. It's a tough question now. It was even tougher for Paul in the Roman church. Especially tougher than in the United States, right? The Christian church here. Paul was writing in difficult times. People, Christians at Rome, wanted and even begged God in their prayers to work and to bring all creation, but especially humanity, to a place of restoration, what they had hoped for. And in the middle of their longings, Paul dares to say, oh, well, these sufferings, yeah, they're here. And that's part of living. We have all this suffering, but guess what? In comparison to the glory that's going to be revealed, they're nothing. Tell that to somebody who's in the middle of serious crisis, right? The reality of serious disease or serious persecution or something else happening that's causing great pain. It's hard, and it is a matter of faithfulness and faith-filled ness here. When Paul speaks of God's glory, what he's speaking of is the manifestation of the true nature of God. It's in the same way when he says that Jesus is the glory of God, it means Jesus is the very nature or character of God revealed. And so he says, you know, it's not worth comparing with the glory. Now, most translations say that is to be revealed to us. The word also means in us, which is an attempt to point toward hope. It's not just affliction from outside, it's affliction from inside, and that's where the real glory can be seen, is when we overcome the affliction from inside ourselves. And so he begins by saying, it looks like suffering is the ultimate reality. Buddha says, suffering is the ultimate reality. And that's all there is suffering. And he says, you know, the sufferings, and I consider, or I reckon. It's not like, you know, I reckon these sufferings, but, you know, I'm considering and I'm thinking about and I'm looking at, I'm perceiving. Actually, the word here, logistomai, means to perceive, to understand. And so he's saying, I perceive, or I come to where I understand now. To this, and he appeals to this shared knowledge. The shared knowledge that we have. For example, in verse 22, he will say, for we know, not just I know, but we. So it's a shared knowledge among Christians. Well, it can't be a shared knowledge if we don't spend the time sharing and getting to know each other. And so that's also a part of this whole thing that he's trying to get them to recognize is that Christianity is not just a totally individualistic thing, it's also part of a larger whole. There is a corporate nature to Christianity as well as an individual nature. And he says, we know, in verse 24, in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for he hopes in what he sees, but if we hope for what we do not see, then we wait for it in patience. So that's part of the shared knowledge with which he's trying to he's trying to encourage them here. So he's saying the sufferings of the present can't compare with the glory, that is the nature or the character, to be revealed, whether it's to us or in us. This present suffering, this present decay, will be overcome as we're transformed inside toward the future. This glory is God's doxa. The Greek word is doxa, glory. And actually, a doxology is supposed to be a statement of glory to God. A doxology. And so for Paul, the coming glory is not yet fully manifested, but will be revealed in us as we live a life of faith, overcoming in us what afflicts us, so that the things outside of us don't overcome us. In good Jewish fashion, and Jewish Christian fashion here, Paul is talking about the heart of the matter, that is, the afflictions that come within us are the things that can destroy us much worse and much more easily than the things that are outside of us. And then if the glory of God can be revealed within us as we live life and overcome those afflictions that come from inside, whether it's the heart or the mind, those afflictions, those things with which we afflict ourselves, we cause problems for ourselves, etc., then the things from outside cannot overwhelm us. The glory of God is revealed in us as we overcome those things that afflict us from inside. Jesus, when he talked about in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, "You shall not murder." But I say to you, anyone who's angry with his brother is liable to judgment. Whoever says racha is liable to the council. And whoever calls his brother a fool, he's liable to the very Gehenna of fire. So his point was not just outward things, but it starts inside. Well, that's what Paul's carrying that same thought here. That oftentimes our afflictions come from inside. Well, that's where they begin. And we let them get out of proportion. And so when God's glory is seen within us and helps us to overcome those, then we can deal with what's outside even more. And so that's the hope that he's talking about here. And yes, Ariel. Right.
And so with through that witness, it seems to me that it's like Paul, when he made his confession, he said, "But I wouldn't take it away because he wanted me to endure through his strength."
Right.
So even though we're weak and we're suffering and we're hurting, through his strength, which is the Spirit, I guess.
Yes, and Paul would equate that here. Right.
Ways, but
that's
hard. Oh, it is. But the Spirit is what dwells. I think what Christ gave us, the Spirit, to help us in our pain and our weakness.
Absolutely. And Christ does give that Spirit for those things inside, etc. And in this passage, he talks later about the Spirit when we groan. Have you ever gotten to where
the only thing,
you couldn't pray, you couldn't come up with the words to pray, all you could do was just moan or groan and didn't know. Well, he says, when that happens, the Spirit groans with us. And since God and the Spirit, God knows the Spirit and Spirit knows God and God knows the mind of the Spirit, he will say, and the Spirit knows the mind of God because they are part of the Godhead together, that the Spirit doesn't have to utter words. The Spirit intercedes for us and on behalf of God, with God, on behalf of us with God when we can't. And so you're right. We get to those points where we want to, and it's so hard to do, and it's only the Spirit that can help us get out of it. But a lot of times we quench that.
Yeah, and like Paul was, he was begging for help. He said,
Yeah. No, and I, you know, no, we don't. Well, is anybody in here wants to suffer? Right.
But. Yeah.
But. But the asking, if you look at it, the asking, and if you look at the context of that with Jesus, the asking is you're not asking selfishly and from your own. You're asking anything that you ask that is within the will or the desire of God, which is the robe. Which is the robe. No, that would not be Buddhism. That'd be Islam, if Allah wills it. But, yeah. No. Oh, yes, absolutely.
If Allah wills it.
Right.
I can ask for it, but if Allah wills it, will be, well, that's the same thing Islam says.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I'm asking, and when I'm doing that, it's not that if it's specifically, okay, God's will, but my will's here. It's asking with my will in tune with the will of God. As opposed to within Islam, Islam is extremely predestinarian. In fact, Islam is totally predestinarian. God's determined everything out there already. And so everything that happens is God's will, good, bad, or indifferent, because it's already been planned. And those who are going to make it, it's already been planned. But, you know, the Ottoman Empire decided that they were the ones who were going, they were the instruments by which Allah would bring those who were going to be into the faith, and the others were infidels, they needed to be slaughtered. Of course, that also happened in the Crusades. It is. And so, you know, we've got this whole thing of, you know, and even the creation, he goes back to the fact that, you know, what happened in the first choice didn't just affect the man and the woman and you and me. It affected everything that God created. The creation groans as well. If you go back to the story in Genesis 3 of the fall, which if you ask a Jew, what do you think about the fall? They'll say, well, that was back in September and October. Because for them, it's not something. That's a Christian term. But if you talk about that in Genesis 3 and the fall, you have the man, the woman. I mean, the serpent loses his legs and crawls on his belly. Explanation for snakes. The woman's got pain in childbirth. The man has to work hard now instead of having this luscious garden he can just pick from. Now he's got to work hard. And the earth will suffer for it. And instead of putting forth everything just nice and neat and pretty, the earth is straining as well. And then animals die so they can be clothed with animal skins. So, you know, all creation was affected and continues to be affected. You know, when humans were given dominion, let them have dominion over these animals. The word there is not dominion as in we're going to take, and never take care of. The whole thing, they were put in the garden to be caretakers, and we're to be caretakers of the creation as well as ourselves and our neighbors. And it says here, you know, there's a cosmic expectation here. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of Him who subjected it, in hope, because the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. Evil and suffering do not represent the true nature of God. And so creation is in a state of imperfection. That's what the word futility here means. But God's glory, Paul says, works and is revealed even when there is suffering and pain. God gave the liberty. By the way, when it says here, and oftentimes we misinterpret this, and I know there are volumes of things that say, "Oh well, it is God who subjected creation to futility." The way God subjected creation to futility, what it's speaking of here is the imperfection given because human beings had a choice and they chose poorly. They're the ones who subjected, not God. It's actually, God gave the liberty to Adam and Eve. He gives liberty to choose to all persons. Creation didn't fall and suffer because it chose. The creation fell and suffered on account of the choices of human beings. Really interesting, but you go all the way back to Genesis and that story, and that's what you find as well in that story. The understanding by the writers that creation suffers because we make bad choices. Forget BP oil spills and things. No. Creation suffers because we make bad choices. Creation initially suffered because humans made bad choices. Yet God is present and has a purpose even within that futility, that imperfection. God wants to create and to restore creation. You get to the book of Revelation, it talks about a new heaven and a new earth. And the sea was no more. A restoration, not just of persons, but a restoration of creation. A restoration of creation. Dr. Joe Blair writes, and I quote, "We often use the word hope, and especially here, hope to mean wishful thinking. However, in the New Testament, hope is the assertion that something is beginning to take shape and nothing will stop it from completion. Nothing will stop God from setting creation free from its bondage and decay, ultimately." End of quote. You know, we think of hope as wishful thinking. For Paul here, when he's talking about that hope that is out there, he ties that hope to not just persons, but to all of creation being made right and perfect once again by God. That's the hope. And through the children of God, that is, through the right choices rather than foolish idolatry. Humans who overreached were the ones that brought the difficulty. And he goes on to say, we know the whole creation has been groaning together until now. And the now is not just now in the moment he's writing to the Romans, but the now of God's time. When God chooses to set it right and make it right. Paul is trying to show that the fate of creation, first of all, was tied to human freedom for bad, but it's also tied to freedom for good when we're liberated by the Spirit of God. And hope then is based on trust in God, not trust in us, but trust in God. The whole creation has been groaning together until now, and not only the creation, but we who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait for adoption as sons and the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Here believers and creation groan in the imperfection, waiting for redemption. Redemption means to be free from that bondage. Free from bondage. Those who have salvation in and through Christ are the first to experience God's restoration. That's what he means by the first fruits. Paul says, if you have Christ, then you experience the first fruits. You get to experience the restoration before those who don't have Christ and before creation. So that's part of the good news. That's also part of the reward of proper choices, properly following God. And it's in that that Paul says we can not be, we can live through and not let suffering overcome us and the questions of suffering overcome us because we have already experienced some restoration. We've already experienced redemption. By the way, the word used here for first fruits, aparke, butter. Aparke, no. Aparke. Here in verse 23, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, grown inwardly as we wait for adoption as sons, the redemption of hope. The first fruits here, that word is used in the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, for to speak of the first part of the harvest, the first fruits, the first part of the herd, the firstlings of the herd or the flock, that represent the whole, that are dedicated to God. And so those who make the choice and continue to make the choice to follow, even in the midst of suffering, will find themselves as the first fruits, the first offerings to God. And it's that hope, Luke Timothy Johnson said, it is the quality of this hope that bridges the present and the future, that allows us to perceive what is not seen in such a way that life can move forward with the expectation our hope will be completed by God. End quote. In fact, he goes on to say, God is even with us in prayer. And Ariel, this comes back to your mentioning weakness a while ago. Here, starting in verse 26. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. You know, there are times that we are weak. We don't know what to pray. Sometimes we groan. Sometimes we don't even groan because we're just wasted, right? We feel that our life, that things around us, you know, we're just wasted. But God says, or he says here, God gives the Spirit to help us. For we do not know how to pray as we ought to. But the Spirit himself intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. In other words, our sighs, and you ever get to that point, I think many of us have admitted, sometimes we've gotten to the point to where we groan and we sigh it comes from the depth of our soul because we just don't know that we can take anymore and we don't know what to say. And what he says here is not only do we have that within us, but if we are those who are being restored and the redeemed and have that hope, God's Spirit sighs even more deeply into our souls than we know. God, through His Spirit, plumbs the very depths of our souls. So those times that we come where we don't know what to pray, or we don't know how to pray. And I don't mean, you know, now lay me down to sleep, pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, don't let my family celebrate. Or, you know, those kinds of things. Or even the Lord's Prayer, but there are times where we really don't know how to pray for something. And it's not just that we don't have the words, but we don't know how we ought to pray. Something happens in life. Well, should I pray this way and ask for this? Or should I pray this way and ask for this? Or should I pray this way? And we don't know how to pray or what to pray. Well, and that's...
In other words,
yeah.
How should I ask with thy will being done being the end of every one? You know, and then what am I supposed to do on this earth that I'm supposed to do for you to make this come true? Sort of like Esther boy, you know.
Right.
Like, this is going to happen, but if you want to be the one to do it, this is what you've got to do.
Well, that's true. But then that brings us to the crux or the question that the lesson writer starts out with. So the basic question here is, do you really believe God's for you or not? Do we really believe God is for us? Right. Right.
You know, even if they did the bad thing or the wrong thing, or they said or behaved in ugly ways, and we got example after example.
Oh, absolutely.
More often than not, man did not behave nicely.
That's true.
And God redeemed it. Think God is for us since we redeemed it.
Right, and that's what he's saying here is, do you really believe that God's for you or not? When you can't pray and you don't know what to pray and don't know how to pray, the only thing that really gets the prayer there is that you hold on to that and you do believe.
What I would like there sometimes, and I might get a little too bold to say, is when it's too much for me to even find words, and I like words, so I have a lot of words. So
no.
If I'm running out of words, I'm really in a bad place. I'd like him to tell me what those words are. Instead of doing it for me, it's kind of like Ken told me how to use the computer. You know,
right.
He do it so I can learn how to do it.
Right.
You know, why? If I can't do it, can God just tell me what those words are so next time around I can have the words?
There are plenty of times I wish that would happen, but you know, it doesn't, and I don't know that if God were to do that I would be able to formulate that or take that in, if it's at such a deep level that I can't even experience it myself and come up with the words. So, I mean, we do tend to get into those kinds of things. And that may be back to your practice of prayer. We get so repetitious that sometimes we need to break that repetition and pray and practice it in different ways, perhaps. Well, there's a difference in foreknowledge and proorizo to predetermine. Or you think you've experienced it before and you can't remember where. But, yeah. And it may be possible that God, something is happening, God brings that recollection back in that moment so that perhaps it might trigger something that makes you either make the right choice or a different choice. I don't know. But there's a difference in foreknowledge, knowing ahead of time, and predetermining what's going to happen. And yeah. Well, he knew, and it's just like one example. It's just like if you are going to God determined ahead of time that anyone who was part of the obedient Israel was to be included in His people. So anyone who belongs to Jesus will be in His people, but we have to choose to belong to Jesus, just as Israel had to choose to follow or not. And it's the destiny to play a part. One example that I ran across in looking at this, it's like a person who joins a sports team. Once you join that sports team and you make that team, you've made that decision, then you are destined before the game. Your destiny is to play and be part of the team. It wasn't your destiny necessarily to get on the team. But once you get on the team and you make that choice, then your destiny, there is a destiny out there that you're supposed to achieve. And yes, Calvin used all kinds of, but I think there's a whole lot more. It's just like Calvinists would say that when in the parable of the sheep and the goats, when he says, you know, the king will sit on his throne and judge them, and he'll separate them as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and say to those on his right, come, enter the kingdom which was prepared for you before the foundation of the world. And they say, ah, see, prepared for you. No, it's not that he predetermined the ones that were going to be there, but he predetermined the kingdom and what the kingdom would be like and kingdom life would be like for those who. He prepared that before the foundation of the world and decided that before the foundation of the world for those who would choose to follow him, that whosoever believes. Now, Calvin would say John 3:16 is the whosoever believes, for God so loved the cosmos, and the whosoever believes, that's just the elect that he predestined. God didn't love the whole world. Jesus didn't come for the whole world. Jesus only came for those that God had predestined. So you've got to, what's the difference in that and the capricious God of another religion? And a voice from God said, you are my beloved son, with you I am well pleased. In his humanity, he chose to limit himself, and that was his choice, and the Father putting his stamp of approval. He had to choose in the Garden of Gethsemane whether he's going to die or not. Because he said, if there's any other way, let it come. But not what I want, but what you think the destiny should be, is basically what he's saying. Which one, the real Isaiah or Deutero-Isaiah, which is the last half of it? No. What about Isaiah? He prophesied, and yet when Isaiah prophesies about what we take as the coming of Jesus, he was thinking it was going to be Hezekiah. He didn't see 700 plus years into the future and say to these people, well, guess what? In about 7.5 centuries, God's going to come in this baby, and that's going to be wonderful news for y'all. Do what? I'm not going to be around. It's just like when he says, gives to Ahaz the sign of Emmanuel. That's something that he thought Ahaz would see in his lifetime, instead of if he said to Ahaz, who had been a pretty lousy guy and had chosen not to follow God but to make his alignment with Tiglath-Pileser and the Assyrians, and he said, you know, this woman's going to give birth to this child, Emmanuel, and if he was talking about somebody 7.5 centuries away, Ahaz doesn't care. He's going to be dead. Joshua.
Well, I thought it was Emmanuel.
Well, Joshua, his Hebrew name was Joshua, which also has to do with God being with us, and Emmanuel is God with us, and so it would be someone who would be born and have a name like that, Emmanuel.
It's not that name.
It's not specifically that name. Sunday school writers sometimes do get that way. That's why I... And that's what we do, but it's just like it's not that God, yeah. You know, but Calvin would argue that, and Calvinists would argue, God didn't send Jesus to die for the whole world. God sent Jesus only to die for the elect in the world that He had already predestined to go to heaven, and the rest, forget it. They had no chance, and that's where you get into 5-point Calvinism. You got irresistible grace. I never met her, but you got irresistible grace. And many are called, fewer chosen. Right. Because you've got the perseverance. You have to choose to persevere, and that makes you one of the chosen. God has chosen to usher the invitation to all, but the only ones who end up being the chosen at the end are those who choose to follow and choose to follow and choose to follow, who persevere to the end. Now, in 5-point Calvinism, it started out as preservation of the saints. Those whom God has elected, God will preserve. But later, some altered it and said, no, it's a perseverance of the saints. Those who are truly the saved are the ones who persevere to the end. I don't know. And God may be reacting to our discussions the same way. Bill Self, who was when CBF first started, Bill Self was at Wyoka Road Baptist Church, and I've told this before, so bear with me, but. He was at Wyoka Road Baptist Church, and he talked at one of those about, you know, defending God and what might God think of some of the things that we do. And Self said that when he went, you know, he got saved and he felt called to ministry, and so when he went off to college, among everything else, he packed up not only his Bible, but in his estimation, he packed up God. And he said, you know, I determined that I was going to lug God through every subject in college. And get God through every subject in college. He said, I almost lost him in chemistry. But, he said, so every day I'd strap on my backpack and I was defending God, defending God, defending God. He said, and one day I got so tired. I'd been in a discussion with some folks and I got so tired that on my way across the quad, I sat down and I looked up at heaven. And I said, God, that's it. I'm not defending you anymore. You're on your own. He said, and I heard this great silence. In heaven. No, this great sigh in heaven. He said, and then a number of years later, I was on the stage at a meeting with opposite J.J. Altizer, who was the big God is dead theologian. And he said, the moderator was sitting there and Altizer gave his big spiel about how God is dead. And then the person turned toward me and said, okay, Bill, I guess now you're going to defend God to us. He said, now my mind works in strange ways. He said, and I kind of sat there and I looked up and thought for a moment, and I could see him staring over the ramparts of heaven. And there's John and James and Jude and Matthew and Simon Peter. Well, he didn't say, and Simon Peter. And he said, all of a sudden I heard this call going back through heaven to the very throne room of God. Self's defending you again. Self's defending you again. He said, and finally when it got all the way to the throne room of God, I waited for an answer. And there was silence. He said, and I decided then, God didn't need me to defend God. All I can do is the best that I can do in trying to understand and interpret. But ultimately, God can take care of Himself and me too. And so I think a lot of times whether they have those discussions or not, right now, there may be a great silence in heaven, or God might be. Yeah, that's right. All this wind out here, maybe God's sighing. Well, and you know, then that, but that kind of, he says the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. And then we'll get back into, well, shoot, we're not going to finish tonight, but we'll get back into this next, not next Sunday, but the following week, picking up in verse 28. In 28 to 30, I will kind of give you a preview. Paul asserts several things about God's overall plan for humans. This transitional statement, we know that in everything God works for good with those who love Him, who are called according to His purpose. That's a transitional statement. Skeptics were questioning God's control of events, especially when evil seemed so rampant. But you know, some of the pagan philosophers not only did that, but if you go and you read Plutarch on the delays of divine vengeance, Plutarch actually defends the fact that God is not out there slaying everyone quickly, but His vengeance has been delayed. And so evil, Plutarch defends God, in a sense, though evil is rampant, for not coming in and wiping everybody out all of a sudden, giving folks an opportunity. Seneca, the writer and philosopher Seneca, in On Providence, defends God in that. But we will pick up in a couple of Sundays with, I'll be here next Sunday. Tom will be here. But you can ask him your question if you want to. But, yes. Yes. The good here is the goal toward which God wants things to go, and those who are called, and who being called according to His purpose means that we belong to God's people, and then we choose to follow that call and share that call and God's life. Those are the ones that are called. Those are the ones when He talks about here who are called, works for good with those who love Him. Interesting way. We often quote it, we know that in everything God works for good for those who love Him. It's actually with those. It's those who are the saints and those who share the life of God with Him, and who are obedient with Him and His purposes. That is, His purpose is the goal for good. So, once again, we come back to the P word, the perseverance part of it, which a lot of folks really don't like. We'd rather it be preserve. Yeah. I came down, I made my decision, I made my commitment, now preserve me. Don't make me persevere. You preserve me. Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, thank y'all. God bless you. Go in peace. And thanks for the input.